there, and welcome to another episode of Horsesense, a show for you, the thinking horseperson. At Horsesense, we give you practical, relevant, up-to-date, and even inspirational information to enrich your horsing life. If you're a first-time listener, welcome. And if you've been here before, welcome back. It's really great to have you. This show is brought to you by the Equine Care Clinic, a clinic dedicated to the care of sick or injured horses when their owners aren't able to. Check out the site at equinecareclinic.com. I'm your host, Amanda Edwards, and this week I'm talking to Jane Myers of Equiculture. Jane holds a Master of Science in Equine Science, is the author of several books on the topic of horse and land management, and is an accomplished horsewoman and instructor in her own right. Jane and her husband Stuart have developed the Equiculture system of managing horses on land in a sustainable manner, and we're going to have a talk about this today. It's fitting that we're talking to Jane, as she is the author of the most popular horse management book in Australia and New Zealand, titled Horsesense. This one's a bit of a longish interview, but it was so interesting I just couldn't cut it short, and it's really a very important topic. Enjoy! Welcome to Horsesense. Thanks so much for being on the show. How are you today?
I'm really good, thank you. It's a beautiful day here in Tambourine, where we are at the moment.
Yeah, I'm really jealous. I love that place. It's awesome. So perhaps if you can tell the listeners who you are, what you do, and how you came to be doing what you do.
Okay, about 10 years ago, I was asked by the CSIRO, the government organisation, to write a book about horses, which it was actually to rewrite a book called Horsesense. So I did that book for them, and then they asked me what would be a good subject to write another book on. And I said that I thought there needed to be a book about land management for horse owners, particularly people who have 5, 10 or 20 acres, because there wasn't really any information out there for people with that sort of property in Australia in particular. Yeah. A lot of the information was, if you wanted a book about land management, it generally came from England or the USA, and a lot of it, I mean, a lot of stuff is the same, but a lot of things didn't carry over as well. So I wrote that book, and it actually became a steady bestseller with CSIRO. So we realised that there was a need for that information. And soon after that, we started doing workshops for people, and we were getting really good turnouts. So we still obviously do. We get really good turnouts to our workshops. And that was how it started, because initially we were just doing the odd workshop here and there, and it's become a full-time occupation for us. In fact, we do it here and now in the UK, and we've done some work in the USA as well. So it was just, I think, one of those niches that we just happened to hit on without realising it. And it's just been, we've been very fortunate that for us that, it's turned into a whole career for us.
Yeah, I know. It's there is a huge need out there for it. And particularly, I think Australian conditions are quite difficult to manage horses, and a growing consciousness about looking after the land and doing the right thing for it, because horse owners traditionally haven't been really good at that.
That's right. It's in Australia, there's actually a few things that come together that mean that a lot of people don't, unfortunately, they actually have problems managing the land. There's the fact that in Australia, the soils are often very poor.
Yeah.
A lot of the areas that get subdivided for horse properties are often actually very poor areas of land anyway, because obviously good agricultural land is worth a lot more money. So a lot of poor areas, like steep areas and rocky areas and really poor soil areas, are what horse people end up with. That's not always the issue, but that happens sometimes. Then there's the issue that in Australia, horses are actually very cheap. It doesn't seem like it to people who live in Australia, but when you've lived outside of Australia, you realise that obtaining horses in Australia is almost too easy, because people can actually get horses virtually for nothing, and sometimes actually for nothing. So it's very easy for people to overstock their land very quickly. And then the third issue is that Australia is the most urbanised country in the world, and most people who have land and horses didn't, nowadays in particular, didn't start out on the land. They actually started out in the suburbs, so they don't actually have that background of land management. The only experience they have, if they buy their own property, the only experience they have of managing their land is usually an adjustment centre, and they tend to keep their horses in a very different way to how you would keep your horses on your own land, because they're looking at it. Well, I mean, some adjustment centres manage their land very well, but a lot of them tend to overstock their land and have one horse in every paddock, and they're not focusing on land management. They're focusing more on just getting more, obviously, because they're having to make a profit. They're having to get, you know, they'll look at getting more and more horses onto a small area of land. And so when somebody gets their own property, that's the only experience they have of managing horses.
That's a very good point. And do you not think, too, that that's kind of a catch-22? Because what then happens is that owners expect that their horses will have its own paddock, its own shelter, and be on its own little own. And, you know, that's not really what horses are about.
That's right. And we often, usually when a lot of the people that come on our workshops, hopefully we catch them just as they've just bought the property and before they put all the wrong facilities in. And occasionally we meet somebody who's bought their own place and they've already put all these little private paddocks in, each with their own shelter in, and then it's too late. They've realised they've done it completely wrong, because that is just not a good way to manage land. It's not a good way to manage the horses, and so on. You know, we've developed over the years a system called the Equicentral system, and it's completely different to that, and it's all about focusing on sustainable management. And that's, you know, one of the things we're most popular for, is looking at the horse within an ecosystem. So that's what we focus on.
And I perhaps I can get you to expand a little bit more on that, because for the listeners, a lot of people will be, when I came across your site, I just thought it was amazing, because I thought this just absolutely makes sense. But tell people a little bit about what Equicentral is all about.
Okay. Well, it sort of started, again, quite a few years ago. Even before we wrote the book, we were going down this in this direction. Typical of a lot of couples who have horses, I'm the really horsey one. I've got a really, you know, very horsey background going right back to when I was very little. And my husband doesn't have that horsey background. Stuart, he's very horsey now, by default. He's a typical horse husband. And he used to constantly say, why are we training out in, because at the time we were living in Victoria, why do we do all the hard work of pushing the wheelbarrow through the mud in the wind and the rain, and the horses just stand there, and you know, they actually want to get back to here, and so that's how it started. Initially I was saying, because that's just the way we do things, Stuart, and he would say, but no, this is totally wrong. And that's how it started. I did eventually start to listen to him, and what we realise, and again, it's a system that has been adopted, like many good ideas, it's been adopted from other areas. So this idea, in a lot of farming systems use it, where you have just one central point, and the animals come to that central point. So it means that the facilities don't have to be replicated in every paddock. Therefore, you build the one large shelter, and that shelter is in use every single day of the year. Rather than building a shelter in every paddock, it means that you have the horses come to that one shelter, that one area for water, so the water's in that area as well, and the paddocks just lead off from that area then it means that you can rotate your pasture, which is ideal because pasture must be rotated. That is what happens in the natural situation, or rather, pasture rotation is the closest we can get in the domestic situation to what happens in a natural situation. Because in the natural situation, animals move across grasslands and move around grasslands. They're not constantly in the same spot. And so pasture does get chance to rest and recuperate in between grazing periods. So rotating pasture is the nearest we can come to that in the domestic situation. But if you have, if you want to rotate your pasture on a horse property and you have a shelter in every paddock, well, if you don't build this one facility, it means you've got to put a shelter large enough for the whole herd in every paddock, which doesn't make sense. So instead you build the one set of facilities. They get used every single day, so you're getting much better value for money for those facilities. And we even talk about how, if you want to, the surfaced holding area that these facilities are in, if you want to, can double up as a riding surface, so then you actually get even better value for money out of those very expensive facilities, which you need to keep horses. And a lot of people do that, particularly amateur horse owners who don't need, a $60,000 arena. But saying that, there's no reason why a $60,000 arena can't double up as your holding area anyway. If it's built correctly, it should be able to stand horses, cope with horses standing on it.
And the other thing I like about that is that they're then only tramping down and compacting one area of soil.
Absolutely. If it's a surfaced area, they're not doing any damage at all. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's really, that for me, because it's been sort of one of the, I guess, the rubs of being a horse owner and wanting to be ecologically sound, it's been hard for me to watch them tramp down and compact soil along fence lines and really, overstock because I've had too small a land, and I might be one of those people that might have collected a horse or two extra that I probably don't need.
yeah, absolutely. That's what everybody does, and it's so hard as a horse owner not to do that, because we've just actually brought a new book out, and it talks all about that sort of thing, how horse owners end up doing in many ways the opposite to what a lot of farms do on their land, because they earn that land for a completely different reason, and so there's a lot of emotion behind keeping horses, obviously. And I'm not saying farmers don't have emotion either, but what I mean is they have to make a living from those animals, so they can't just collect animals willy-nilly or whatever, because they can't do that. And so when a drought is on, for instance, whereas a farmer will usually reduce their stock, a lot of horse owners, particularly the conscientious ones, end up with even more horses, because they end up collecting the ones that other people can't manage anymore, and so they end up with even more animals. And so, but this system means that as long as it does mean, obviously, well, any in a drought you're going to have to buy feeding anyway, and it means that you could have those extra horses without doing any more damage on your land, because what you do when the conditions aren't right for grazing is that you feed them on hay in the holding area, so they can always get back to the holding area. You never prevent them from, so they never stand in a gateway behind the gateway waiting to be let back in. They can always get themselves back. But in times when it's very wet or very dry, which is very common in Australia, it means that if you need to, you can hold them in that area, not let them on the land at all, so they're not doing that damage to the land, which will cause problems further down the line if you let them out, which is, if it's very wet, they'll cause pugging to the soil, and if it's very dry, they'll overgraze the plants and then shatter the plants, so it's very hard for them to grow back, and in the future all you get is more weeds. Whereas if you use your holding area correctly, then you won't have those problems, and when the times are good, you'll have abundant grazing.
Yeah, and the other thing about that is that, in winter we see a lot of seedy tow and thrush and hoof issues that turn into abscesses and all of those sorts of things, which are seriously helped by this system. You don't see that, do you?
That's right. There's such big problems. Particularly wet areas, obviously, huge problems with greasy heel. That just completely disappears when you start using this system.
Yeah. So what are some of the other benefits of using an Equa Central system, both for the land but also for the horse?
Well, basically, what you're doing is you're actually creating a mini home range. Now, horses in the wild live in what's called a home range. They don't migrate like a lot of other large grazing herbivores who move across a continent, for instance. So think about things like wildebeest in Africa. They move across the continent. It takes them a year to get there and back. That's the normal pattern. Horses, and zebra in Africa and so on, they live in what's called a home range. So they have an area that they stay in. That area might be very large in areas, so Brumbies, for instance, in Australia. They're not native to Australia, but they live wild, obviously. Horses live wild in Australia. And they have, where the resources are very spread out, they have a very large home range. So Brumbies in Australia, their home range might be, is huge, absolutely huge. In other areas of the world where their resources are much closer together, like the New Forest in the UK, for instance, where ponies live wild, their home range is relatively much smaller because they don't need to travel as far to get to the water and the food and the shelter. So horses adapt the size of their home range depending on how far they have to get to resources. When you create an equicentral system on your property, what you're doing is you're actually creating, you're giving them a home range. So yes, it's small, but their resources, but the horses are fine with that because horses don't voluntarily move, many, many kilometres a day for the fun of it. They move because they have to get to the food. Obviously, we want them to move as much as possible because they need that movement, but when we only have 5 or 10 acres, when we can only make the move around that 5 or 10 acres. So at least we're doing the best we can with what we've got. So we're providing that home range. We're allowing the horses to make decisions about when they want to go and graze, when they want to go stand in the shelter, when they want to lie down to go to sleep, rather than us micromanaging them and saying, you will go now in the paddock for 8 hours and graze, then I will let you back in at 5 o'clock and give you a feed, and then you'll stand in the yard or the stable overnight. Instead, we're giving them the choices back, and as a herd, they can make those decisions, so they are much, much calmer, much happier, for want of a better word, because we're giving them that freedom so that in their own time, they're able to live in a much more natural way than they would, that they do in the traditional horse management system. So that makes a huge difference to horses, because the more I've thought about it over the years, coming from a very traditional way of keeping horses, when I didn't used to even think that way, to the way that I think now, like a lot of horse owners who've had horses a lot of years, it really hits you eventually what you've been doing to horses all this time. It's not good the way a lot of horses are kept and micromanaged and never allowed to make any decisions about who they stand with, where they stand, when they drink, when they lie down and so on.
I think that is so true, and my own experience would reflect that. I've had horses since I was, a tiny child. And I just was like you. I thought that's just the way we look after horses and how we take care of them. So I thought I was caring for them. And now that I know so much more, I actually think about this in terms of the way we have, we're not supposed to anthropomorphize our horses and experience. But if you think about the analogy that I have in my head and the picture is the person that's stuck in the corporate box, living, going to work, getting up in the morning, going to work, coming home, being told what to do, living very sedentary lifestyle, so, and getting obese and being unhealthy and all of those things that are associated for us with not moving also relate to the horses. And it just gives me that picture, and I have a little sort of smile to myself and think, God, all those years I was putting my horses in a corporate box.
That's right. They, in so many ways, modern domestic horses are having all the same problems we are as a species. They're living longer, which is, you know, not necessarily a problem, but because of that, that's one of the factors. They're suffering from lots of obesity-related disorders, just like we are. They're more likely to be fed on you know, high-energy junk food, for a better want of a better word, you know, food that's too high in energy for what they're actually doing, because most horses, especially in Australia, because again of this factor of, you know, it's so easy to collect horses, that means you've often got a lot of horses who are doing nothing in terms of work or exercise or whatever. But because they're living longer as well, we still tend to think of retiring them at around 20 years old, because we think of that as being an old horse, whereas in fact that's only a middle-aged horse. When you think that a lot of horses now live well into their late 30s, so stopping riding a horse when he's 20 years old means that he's often going to have at least another 20 years of doing absolutely nothing, and so that's where some of the issues are coming in as well with obesity. Simply the horse, you know, the horse could carry on and do things, not necessarily at the level that, obviously, not at the level that he was doing things when he was younger, but just like us, he needs a change of workload, but he must still be kept moving, hopefully, until virtually the day he dies, because just like us, you know, we need to keep doing things as long as we possibly can. We know that. And it's the same for our horses. If we just, you know, put them in tiny spaces and they don't move, of course they're going to have lots of problems. And a lot of the, you know, so-called solutions that are out there are all about, you know, say, changing the food and so on, but they're not focusing on what the horse really needs, which is more movement. Even companionship with other horses will create more movement, because when horses are together, they move each other around a bit, they, you know, they play together. Horses are one of the only species of herbivores that play right into old age. And think about mature cows and sheep. Once they get to maturity, they don't play the same way that horses do. A healthy horse will still run around and play into old age. You know, if we allow that to happen, if we encourage that to happen, again, that's more movement. That's natural movement that the horse should be getting. As well as we need to create sometimes some unnatural movement in the form of exercise. In our workshops now, we've even started talking about things like start thinking of, you know, you take your dog for a walk, or hopefully you do if you've got a dog. Think, you know, if you're not riding the horse anymore, start taking the horse for a walk. Anything, just to get that horse moving. You know, there's no reason why you can't take a horse for a walk if you live in, you know, if you've got the right environment around you. You know, so if you're not riding the horse anymore, do other things with it instead.
I think that's a really good point. And the other thing that I'm really interested in that you talk about is parasite management. And I've just done an article for Horsewise on parasite management, and I was reading all the latest information. And the number of studies now that are coming out showing the resistance that we're getting, that a lot of people are relying on 6-weekly worm paste, and that's not going to cut it for much longer at this rate. So talk about how aquaculture works on that front.
Okay. Well, interesting, yes, the equicentral system helps with that as well. Well, in particular, a rotational grazing system, again, because it goes back to that natural, more natural way of keeping grazing animals, in the natural system, it's that movement, it's that where the animals are not always grazing over the same area, and in the natural system there's always more than one type of animal grazing a given grassland. Those factors are what keep parasites at a manageable level for horses in the wild situation, or for all grazing animals, because what happens is, for instance, there's various things happening, such as most parasites are what's called host-specific, which means that they've evolved along with a particular animal. So when a different animal inadvertently picks those worms up when they're grazing the same area of land, those parasites die out in that animal system because they've not evolved with that animal. So that's one of the ways that parasites are managed in the wild situation. So when we cross-graze in the domestic situation, we're actually copying that. So that's a really good thing. That's what farmers use a lot to actually help to manage worms. Then there's also other factors such as dung beetles. And Australia has actually been quite amazing in that they've looked for dung beetles to actually help to manage parasites in grazing animals. Interestingly, when they were first... Well, I'll just go back a bit. Dung beetles are native to Australia. Australia does have some native species of dung beetles, but they've evolved along with the marsupials that are native to Australia. Yeah. So they are, if you like, overfaced with piles of cattle dung, cow dung, and horse dung, and so on. They're not able to cope so well with those introduced animal species dung. And so Australia, about 50 years ago, started to introduce dung beetles from countries such as Africa and parts of Europe, where they are used to dealing with, where they have evolved to deal with these larger grazing animals' dung. And they've been a huge success in Australia, so much
Absolutely.
So that they actually stopped the program about, I think it was about 20 years ago, but they're now looking to reintroduce more species because over the years they've realized that they've been an even bigger success than they first thought they were going to be. They've done even more than they could ever imagine. So dung beetles do a huge range of jobs in terms of improving the soil, but they also, what they do is because they take the dung underground, they make it so that the parasites can't survive. They reduce their habitat, if you like. So
Absolutely.
They've vastly reduced the parasites of grazing animals. So that means then that we need less worming chemicals, and therefore that these chemicals are going to stay effective for longer because we're not overusing them, which is what's happened in the past. In the past, we've just used them literally, willy-nilly.
Yep. Well, it's actually worldwide, and it's a bit like the antibiotic resistance in humans, but what worries me about that is that in animals, there isn't the money to research new medications or drugs to anti-thelmy. So to get your wormer pastes, we're stuck with what we've got, and we've got to really look at that futuristically.
That's right. And there's even another school of thought that really we don't even necessarily want to eradicate worms. We just need to get them to the low levels, which is what would happen in the natural situation. Because that way then the animals maintain their own levels of natural resistance, and that's what we want. If we actually completely eradicate worms, then the next generations of animals won't have any immunity whatsoever, and then if the worms do come along, they'll be completely susceptible to them. So again, the more we can try to copy what happens in nature, because as we all know, nature pretty much has things worked out. So the more we can try and copy what's happening in nature, the more healthier system will tend to be. So that, again, dung beetles are another way of replicating what happens in the natural system, combined with other things like cross-grazing. Rotating your pastures, again, is yet another factor, because it means that the worm eggs that hatch out, if that paddock is currently in a rest phase, so there's no animals grazing in there, those worm eggs that hatch out to larvae, some of them won't actually survive long enough for the animals to get back into the paddock, and so some of them will die out before the animals get back again. So that's yet another way of reducing worms on your pasture.
So how long should a rest period be?
Well, that's a little bit like, how long should a piece of string be? But it basically, it's until the grass has recovered to enough to a point to where it can cope with grazing again. So in our workshops, we talk about how really the grass should be between about 5 centimetres and between and 15 to 20 centimetres. It should be in that range before you graze it again. Now, how long it takes to get back to that stage depends entirely on the amount of rainfall combined with sunlight, obviously. Usually in Australia, sunlight's not a problem. It's the rainfall usually that's a limiting factor. So in certain areas, that grass will regrow in no time at all, within another week or two. In other areas, it might actually be months before it gets to that. Before it gets to that length, and obviously the season has a lot to do with that. So, in some parts of Australia, the grass is not going to grow at all for 6 or 7 months of the year, whereas in other areas it grows more or less all year to some extent. So this is where that holding yard comes in, because in the past, before people thought this way, they expected their land to cope with the horses being turned out on it, whether it was 24/7 or just 8 hours a day or whatever, that they would turn their horses out every day of the year, every season of the year, no matter whether it rained for the last 6 weeks or not rained for the last 6 months, they would just turn their horses out. Whereas, once you start to understand land management a lot better, you realise you just cannot do that. There will be some properties in some areas where they can almost get away with that, but there'll be other areas, particularly in drought affected areas, where you just cannot do that, because otherwise when the weather conditions do improve, all that's going to grow back is weeds, because you've overgrazed it at the other time. So by having that holding area, you can completely control how much pressure that land gets. And don't forget that when you turn horses out onto land that doesn't have good grass on it, the horses don't move around anyway, because people often say to us, well, I don't like the idea of locking the horse up in the yard. And as we explain, if you turn a horse out onto a bare paddock, which is, in Australia, a lot of paddocks quickly get to that stage, he doesn't walk around going, oh, well, I know there's no grass, but I need to keep fit, so I'll keep walking. The only way he'll actually stand at the gate for hours and hours waiting to be let back in. Once he's worked out there's no feed in there, he'll either stand at the gate waiting to be let back in, or if you put him out in a paddock on his own and there's other horses nearby, he will tend to just walk the fence line. So either way, yes, if he's walking the fence line, that's a form of exercise, but that's a stereotypic behaviour. We don't want that. That's not good movement, because the horse is doing it for completely the wrong reason. And if he's standing at the gateway, all he's doing is compacting the soil around the gateway. This is why on horse properties you often see gateways in some areas that are 3 feet lower than the rest of the paddock, because the soil is completely worn away. Start to get your head around this way of thinking, you realise that if he's going to stand around because there's no pasture to eat, he might as well stand around on a surfaced area eating hay as stand out on the paddock, making it even worse. So again, it works beautifully that way. So in those times of the year when there's no feed, you can use that holding area to completely control how much grazing pressure they put on the land, so that when the conditions are right, you're going to have the best potential situation. You're going to have as much grass as possible for your given area of land. And this is what we're finding with people who do this. In no time at all, some people actually end up with too much grass. Then they can actually start to do things if they want, like cross graze, can actually get other animals in and get all the benefits that come of having those other grazing animals.
Well, that sounds, that's really fantastic. So one more thing that I know that you talk about is most people, when they first hear 5 to 20 centimetres, go, oh my God, my grass hasn't been that long for a decade longer. But also, when we talk about our insulin-resistant horses or our Cushing's ponies or horses, talk about what that means for them.
Yes, definitely. Quite in the last few years, there's been a fair bit of research done looking at the length of grass and horses and so on, particularly in the UK. And we travel over to the UK for a few months of every year now, so we're trying our best to keep up to date with all this new information that's coming out. And what we now know is that the shorter the grass is, the more it has per mouthful of sugar. So, for instance, if grass is only 2 centimetres long, then per mouthful, that grass is actually relatively higher in sugar than grasses that are much longer. So when grasses are longer, they're actually using up their sugars to grow the grass, and the sugar tends to be concentrated at the base of the plant, and the rest of the plant tends to be more fibrous. So just to reiterate that, really short grass is low in fiber and high in sugar, and longer grass is higher in fiber and per mouthful lower in sugar. Plus the sugars are right down at the base of the plant. So the horse has to eat down through the longer fibrous parts of the grass to get to the sugars, because they tend to be nearer the base of the plant. Now, when a lot of the information, a lot of the reason I think it comes about that people put horses out on short grass is because they think that information comes from cattle farming, I think. Because if you put a cow out on short grass, it's harder for them to eat, because cows eat in a different way to horses. Horses have the equipment in their mouth for eating really short grass. They're able to eat grass when it's only 1 centimetre long or even lower. So they're able to eat that really short grass and get lots of food value out of it, if you like. Whereas if you put a cow out on that short grass, they wouldn't be able to.
Yeah,
with a horse, it's the opposite, because they've evolved to fulfill a different niche. The horses can live on what other animals leave behind, because they've got pairs of incisors that meet in the mouth like a pair of scissors, and they're able to eat really short grass. So by keeping our grasses longer, but by still controlling the amount they eat if needs be, so if our horses are obese, we can't let them out 24/7 on short or long grass, because they will overeat either way. They'll either eat lots of really short grass, or they'll eat lots of really long grass and still eventually get the same amount of sugar. So we still need to control their intake, because we need to remember that in the wild situation, they would have to be walking, probably around up to 80 kilometres a day, actually sometimes even more. They would be walking huge distances, and that food would be much lower quality. In the domestic situation, they're not having to walk as far, and generally, usually, the food is much higher quality. So we still need to be sensible about it, but by having them eat the really short grass, we're not doing them a favour, and we're actually creating the conditions on our land where we'll actually end up with a monoculture of short grasses in the end, because they're the only ones that can cope with that grazing routine, that regime, and that's all we end up with in the end, is those really short grasses, and we lose all that biodiversity of all those other different types of plants, which have all sorts of other good things in them for our horses, you know, all sorts of benefits.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about losing the grasses as well, so that's, I think, a critical point. So moving on to, do you have, if you already had a setup, is it possible for you to put an equicentral system in place without, and does it all cost a lot of money to do?
No, it actually usually would cost you a lot less than setting up a traditional system. But if you already have a traditional system set up, and we come across this a lot in the UK where people already have a stable yard and stables and so on, what we talk about in particular there is, so for instance, what people are starting to do over there is they've already got the hard standing in front of the stable, so that can become their holding yard. They might even take the fronts of the stables off and turn it into what we call a running shed. So that's something you can do within an already established traditional system. You could actually just have it where you put a roof over the hard standing, leave your stables as they are, because they can still be useful for tacking up, for handling horses, for feeding any supplementary feed. If you've got older horses, obviously, or some horses need that supplementary feed. So you can still use your stables for separating your horses for that reason. So if you've got stables, it doesn't mean you're not going to get to use them. But if you haven't built stables yet, we usually say it's better to build one big surface holding yard with individual yards off the side. Is usually a better arrangement. But if you already have stables, you can certainly integrate them into that system. If you've already got a lot of people who've already got an arena, then what they do is they start using that as the holding yard. They might even put a roof over one end of it, and then, hey, presto, they've got a half a covered arena. And then again, you would need separate small yards to put the horses in for supplementary food, and for those times when you want to use your arena, obviously you need to put your horses into separate yards so that you can concentrate on the one that you're riding. So there's lots of things you can do with facilities you already have. You're not creating something that's you know, in any way unusual to the setup of any other property, really. You're not making your property either that it's typecast in a certain way, so that if you were ever to sell the property, it's going to be difficult for, you know, it's going to make it harder to sell. That certainly doesn't happen because, as I say, you're either using what you already have as a traditional system, or you're building, you know, covered holding yards, which again is going to suit anybody else who comes along with whatever type of animal they've got.
Yeah, okay, that's really good. And obviously, if you're doing a new setup, you save all the money on piping water to every yard and putting a shelter in every yard and all of that sort of stuff as well. So
absolutely, and actually a further point is if you have bought a bare block, and so therefore you never need to pipe water out to all the individual paddocks with this system. So if you only need water in the one area in the holding yard, which is usually by the house, near the house as well, that's what we usually advise, is put it somewhere near the house, because it makes it easy for you to keep your eye on the horse. It also means that the horses will voluntarily, happily spend lots of time standing there, because that's what horses do, is they like to stand where they can see human activity, because they know that's where extra feed is more likely to come from. So they'll stand there, they'll come there for water. It means that you don't have to pipe water out to a paddock. It means that you don't have to go check water in the morning, for instance, before you go off to work. If you already have water out in your paddocks, that's not bad either, because it means that you can turn that water off when the horses are using it. But if you ever do cross-grade with other animals, so if you want to fasten cows in a paddock, for instance, then you just turn the water back on for when they're in there. So there's pros and cons both ways. But if you don't yet have water piped out to your paddocks, I mean, we've come across people who literally, have, before they've gone to work in the morning, they've carried buckets of water, you know, out quite large distances to paddocks and so on. You don't need to do that. You get the horses walking to the water rather than you walking out with the food and the water, rather than you pushing the wheelbarrow and carrying the buckets. The horse now starts to do some of that for themselves, and they're quite happy to do that. It's just that in the past we've prevented them doing that by fastening them behind a locked gate. Yeah, we just open the gate and let them come to where they want to be. And they're more than happy to do that.
And we make a rod for our own back, don't we?
Absolutely, we do. We do. Very much so.
So tell me one more thing about, what was I going to say? No, that's evaded me. So in terms of, I know what the question was. Some horse owners will say to me, oh, well, I couldn't put all my horses together because I've got mares and geldings.
Yeah.
And I've got 10 of them, and this one will kick that one, and then my horse is really, I don't want him to get kicked or bitten. So what do you say to that?
Okay. Well, every situation is different when it comes to how you actually, the herds that you make on your property. So, for instance, if you already have quite a few horses, and just say you've got 10 mares and geldings, in that situation, we wouldn't usually advocate throwing the whole lot in together anyway, because that would be a very large herd. In the wild, a herd usually consists of one stallion, sometimes some juvenile males, but about five or six mares and their offspring. So a horse herd is not very large in the natural situation. Throughout the day, that's what's called a band, and those bands will often join together with other bands, but at certain times of the day they'll be separate, and other times of the day they'll all be one big band, one big group, where there might be 50 or 60 horses all together. So the stallions will actually intermingle to some extent, and it's quite fascinating to see. Anyway, we're getting off track there a little bit. So in the domestic situation, if you did have 10 mares and 10 geldings, then it's a good idea to have a gelding group and a mare group. So in a gestation situation, for instance, that is often a very good idea to do that. If it's just a private property and you've got, say, five or six horses, just say you have four geldings and two mares, that could be a problem, because that is not really a natural group in the wild situation. Because what is a more natural group is one mature male and the rest female. So again, you might create two groups for yourself, which will mean having to have two equicentral systems. So it's better if you don't have to do that. Occasionally you will come across a group where you can actually get four geldings living quite happily with two mares, but it doesn't happen often. A better grouping is more mares and just one gelding, because then that's a much more natural grouping. So sometimes you might need to have more than one group. Sometimes you might have to have two groups, and sometimes you can actually get them all together.
But you can actually set that up. I've seen some of the pictures of the where you've set that up, where you've got the groups living in sort of two bands, So it's not, again, that's not impossible either. It's just a bit of different thinking around how you put it all together.
That's right. And this is one of my particular bandwagons. I find it very interesting. Mares often get the rap for being mares, but the problems are actually usually geldings, because each gelding wants to have his own little harem. And so it's geldings who generally won't share. So they're actually the problem. If you have too many geldings and not enough mares, that can sometimes be a problem. But again, we should be looking to get our horses living in herds, because that is the natural way of living. Saying that, you do sometimes come across horses who've been separated for so long, they literally have no social skills. They're either too aggressive or too passive when they're mixed with other horses. Sometimes they will learn to be, learn how to interact with other horses, and sometimes they won't. So you can't just throw them all in together and let them get on with it. You've got to be very careful how you introduce them.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So we're coming to the end of the chat, which has been absolutely, I think, fantastic, and I'm so pleased we're doing this. So if we can tell the listeners, maybe if you can wrap up with a few key tips for success, or key thoughts.
We need to start thinking more about your horse's behaviour. Start thinking more about how horses themselves would want to live. Start looking to learning more about horses' behaviour is what I would say. I've been interested in the subject of behaviour for many years, and that's certainly what is very much woven into the system that we advocate now, is looking to how horses behave naturally. Because if you don't, then we will have a lot of problems. Basically, we can force horses to do things, and that's what we've been doing for generations now. But it doesn't really work. We create lots of health problems for our horses by doing that. That's why we see lots of ulcers and also stress-related behaviours, windsucking, weaving, all those types of things. all, they don't happen in naturally living horses. They happen in domestic horses. They happen in zoo animals before zoos started looking to keep their animals better. In fact, if a zoo kept their animals the same way that we often keep domestic horses, they would go out of business because it just would not be allowed. It's as simple as that. You know, if you kept large animals in small cages and put collars on them for doing certain behaviours and so on, they just wouldn't get away with it. And yet we get away with it in the horse industry, and we need to really think about what we're doing and start to change the way we're doing things. Otherwise, we will actually eventually lose the right to keep horses, because a lot of animal rights people are already turning to looking at how we keep horses and starting to point the finger, basically.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a really great way of thinking about it. And so I think that's an awesome point to leave on. Where can people find more information, Jane, about what you're talking about?
Well, we have a lot of people tell us it's true. We have a great website. That's www.equiculture.com.au. We've got lots of information on there. There's lots of links on there every time we find out something interesting and good websites and so on, we link them on our website. So there's loads of information on our website. I've just finished writing, Stuart and I have just finished rewriting our books. So we have three books all about the Equicentral system, one about the ethics of keeping horses, one about grasslands and horses, about you know, pasture management in detail, and one about horse facilities. So there's three books in that series, and they have literally just gone to press, so they're available now. So there's lots of, and then obviously there's our workshops. If you look on our website, we list where our workshops are going to be. So we're in Australia for about 7 months of the year. We mainly do workshops in the eastern states. We also usually do one in Tasmania and South Australia. And then the rest of the time is over in Europe, looking at things over there. And integrating that information into what we teach here, and vice versa. We take a lot of good ideas over to the UK, and they're really getting into what we teach over there because of the big issues they have over there are with mud in particular. So they're loving our system, absolutely loving it. So there's lots of ways that people can find out more. Oh, and we also have a few good Facebook pages as well, but the addresses for those are on our website.
Yep. I will also put links on the show notes to your website and make sure that everybody's got it, and I can recommend the books. I've got them all. and the workshop is really great stuff. So I would like to thank you, Jane. You've been very generous with your time today, and we have done a longer interview, but I just think this is such an important topic that I think it's really, really worth it. So thanks. Thanks very much for being on the show. I know that the listeners are going to love it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
So, what do you think? There's lots of things that challenge our traditional thinking about keeping horses and managing the land, aren't there? There were so many learnings for me that I don't know where to start, especially since I've just bought my own very quite large horse property. Here are my top three takeaways. Number one. Horses don't necessarily need stables and don't like to be kept on their own. That's what we like. Think like a horse and understand grazing habits. Number two, not many moons ago, people thought it was okay to keep mantakis on leashes and wild animals cooped up in small cages on their own in zoos. Now that would be considered cruel and unacceptable. So what implication does this have for us as horse owners? Do we need to change our management of horses to match the times we live in and make sure that we're up to the scrutiny that we're going to come under? Number three, Equicentral's not hard to do and it's not expensive. It can be done on small blocks of land or big ones. Why don't you give it a try? What did you find most interesting or confronting about that chat? Leave a comment and a review on iTunes or on the show notes at horsesenseshow.com. Call me needy, but I'd love to know if I'm not talking to myself out here. Don't forget to like us on Facebook at the Equine Care Clinic for more great tips too. And keep an eye out for our latest workshops. Our first response workshops are really, really helpful. Give you all the information you need to know to look after your horse when things go wrong. Big thanks to Angus Strachan, who puts this show together and makes me sound half reasonable. And until next time, may your horsing be great horsing, and goodbye.